Tonight we move into the fulfilling of the Torah. There's actually six subjects Jesus deals with. We'll look at three tonight and three next week, where he's quoting from the Old Testament, quoting from Deuteronomy. You have heard it said, but I say to you. That's kind of the formula. It's a good tag statement, really, for all of the Sermon on the Mount, but really all of the New Testament and how we think about Christianity as well, that Jesus would say, I did not come to abolish or abandon the law, I came to fulfill it. And so however we interpret these things, we have to be reminded that Jesus wasn't advocating crumbling up and throwing away the Jewish heritage, the Old Testament, the portrayal of God in those pages. That was not what he was advocating. What he would say was, I'm trying to fulfill that. Now, fulfilling, interestingly enough, is not as easy a word to define and interpret as we might think. I usually tell people, in today's Christian economy, we always interpret fulfillment to be attached to prophecy. Prophecies are fulfilled. And so when we hear about fulfillment, we want to start going and looking in Isaiah or Jeremiah or Moses. Jesus must be fulfilling a prophetic statement. And yet, if you read Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews clearly identifies Jesus as the fulfillment of institutions, of roles of leadership. He would say Jesus is the fulfillment of the sacrificial system. Sacrificial system wasn't a prophecy. It was a method or a facet of the Israelites' worship. And he said Jesus fulfills that. Jesus fulfilled the priesthood. He is the great high priest. Again, that was an institution. It says that Jesus was greater than Moses. Jesus is greater than the angels. And so fulfillment is a much broader idea than just prophecies. That being said, when Matthew uses the word fulfill, he most often is talking about what? Most talking about prophecies. Remember, Matthew's gospel is the bridge. It's the bridge writing between the Old Testament community and the New Testament community. It's why it's placed first. He's the most Jewish of the four gospels. He quotes and alludes to the Old Testament more than any of the others. He was writing to a Jewish audience. And so I've given you some examples there. On Roman number 1, point 2, we can look at Matthew 1, Matthew 4, Matthew 12. When Matthew uses the word fulfill, he's usually referring to prophetic fulfillment. So, when he says of Jesus, or he says in the mouth of Jesus, I didn't come to abandon the law, but to fulfill it. In the history of Christianity, some have said what Jesus means by to fulfill is, he's come to pile on. Here's what the laws have said, and I've come to make them even stricter than they were before. I'm adding to it. That's what fulfill means. In other parts of our history, we've had traditions or writers that have said fulfill means, when Jesus says, I've come to fulfill it, it simply means he came to execute the law in a way that the rest of humanity could not. I didn't come to do away with it. I came to live it out in its perfection. And you may not be able to do that, but that's why I'm here. I'm here to be that great human example of how the law, to show how the law can be obeyed fully. A third possibility means to fulfill. Fulfill means to perfect. That's what we mean when we say Jesus fulfilled the sacrificial system, right? He perfected it. Hebrews would even say that. Back then, it was the blood of bulls and goats, and they had to do it every year. But Jesus, the sacrifice was once for all. It was a perfected fulfillment. And so that's a possible understanding of fulfillment here. That what Jesus is saying is he's not adding on, he's just saying, look, this is what the laws always meant. They always meant this, it just wasn't understood that way. When the law says you shall not murder, it was always intended to mean Don't be angry or spiteful or violent towards your brother. Murder is just the end extreme, but that's never been understood. And so Jesus is fulfilling it by communicating its more perfect example. Fourth means, Jesus says, I've come to fulfill the law, means through the work of Christ, and we, I would assume by the granting of the Holy Spirit, that he is finally enabling other people to live it out and fulfill it. Have you seen or found that to be the case in your life or anybody's life that you know? I suppose that's a possibility, but I don't know that any of us are living out Torah perfectly. Some would say that fifth bullet point, number E, that when Jesus said he came to fulfill the law, what he was doing was reducing all of the jots and tittles and numerous arguments to the simple commandments of love God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That we're really just fulfilling it and saying, you don't need to worry about all the specific details and nuances. What you do is live your life loving God and loving your neighbor, and that is the fulfillment of Torah, fulfillment of law. And the sixth is, they would argue that really what it's saying is the fulfillment of Torah. Remember, Torah could be the laws specifically, but the law also speaks to Genesis through Deuteronomy, a section of the Old Testament, that entire part of the Old Testament. And that what Jesus meant to say was he's fulfilling the prophecies. Some would look at Genesis, you know, to bruise, the serpent will bruise his heel, but he will crush his head. The prophecies sometimes read in Abraham taking his son up to sacrifice on Mount Moriah. The prophecy, you know, what if in reading in prophecies in Moses' deliverance of the Israelites from slavery, that Jesus is fulfilling the entire sense of the law, the Torah, in his life and in his actions, that it's more of an eschatological kingdom of God fulfillment. So, who knew one word could be so complex? And by the way, that's six categories. And if you surveyed all of the academic literature on that word and on this passage, you're going to find probably 40 or 50 different options. This is just kind of boiling them down into blanket categories. It's fair to say that not all six of these are uniquely independent. There is overlap. It's also fair to say that the correct answer could be more than one of these. It could be a combination of several of these. I think that it's significant that when we see in Matthew him using the word fulfill, he's talking about fulfilling prophecies, fulfilling prophetic statements. Let's look at those that I've got listed there. If you have a Bible, you can follow along. If not, I'll just read them for you. Matthew 1, 21, is that right? 22. He says, all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. Chapter 4, verse 14. Jesus begins to preach. He's leaving Nazareth, goes to Capernaum, verse 14, to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah. Fulfillment of prophetic utterance, fulfillment of Isaiah. And then again, chapter 12, verse 17. The context here is it's Jesus teaching. Aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place, many followed him. This was to fulfill, verse 17, what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. It's not an automatic. But let's look at chapter 5, verse 17. Jesus says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. He doesn't just say the law, even though he's going to reference laws in these next few passages. I did not come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. So he also says he's fulfilling the prophets, not just the law. For us, so many times, remember, we read law and we think law codes. In a Hebrew context, the word is Torah, and Torah represents all five of those books. And while we usually translate Torah as law, in a Hebraic context, the word much better is rendered as instruction. Now, law and instruction are similar, but in the ancient world, law meant the way you instruct children to train them up so they know what to do is right. In our modern day, we think of law as our system of sometimes very voluminous codes of law, legalese. When Jesus says, "I did not come to abolish the Torah or the prophets, but I came to fulfill them," we have to read Torah correctly and understand it in a biblical context, not in a modern American context. So what do you make of the concept of fulfillment? Jesus didn't come to abolish these things, he came to fulfill them. As an Old Testament scholar, I like this verse a lot, because in modern Christianity and in modern preaching, most people don't want to have anything to do with the Old Testament. Now, that doesn't matter. You don't need to read the Old Testament. We're New Testament Christians. We read the Gospels and Paul. Jesus would say, it's part of the same witness. It's inspired by the same God. I didn't come to abandon what God had revealed and spoken in the Torah and in the prophets. Rather, I came to fulfill what had been revealed and spoken and built in the Torah and the prophets. So, this is the intro verse to where we're going. Let's read the rest of that introduction. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. I've always read that, and I've been torn between commandments. When you hear the word commandments in the context of the Torah, what do you think? You think the Ten. So is Jesus referring to the Ten Commandments there? Or is Jesus referring to all of the nuances of the legal code? Could be. Yeah, I mean, if he's referring to all the legal codes, then it's all of the random laws in Exodus and in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. But the word commandments, we wish that there was more information here. We would love to ask for clarification. Can you be more specific? But what we have is what we have. For I tell you, verse 20, that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. I do think that that last qualifying verse is important. Jesus is not trying to create a puzzle here. He's setting up a contrast. And for those that are listening to his sermon, he's pointing to the religious leaders who we know from the rest of the Gospels Jesus identified as ritualistic and legalistic and followed all the checks and boxes, but really did not display a spirit of righteousness or love or mercy or compassion. And we get the distinction between what empty religion looks like versus what character of Jesus looks like. We have seen and maybe lived ourselves in times where both of those have been representative of us. And so what Jesus is trying to tell people is, look, these are people who spend a lot of time studying the Torah and trying to follow the very legalistic nuances of it, but your righteousness, unless it surpasses theirs, then the kingdom of heaven does not belong to you. That's not the standard by which this is measured.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between the decree and the statute?
Oh, I don't know that I have an off the top of my head answer for you, Theda. I think the formula that's rattling in my head is laws, commands, and statutes. But therein lies the challenge, as we're translating Hebrew words that sometimes to us in English, those would almost be synonymous. What's the difference in a law and a command? I do think that there were... Right. Yeah, everything. I do think that in the Jewish rabbis would distinguish between the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, all of the qualifying laws borne out in the biblical laws, and then you have a lot of rabbinical tradition in Mishnah where they are further extrapolating on the laws themselves. But you have different categories, and I don't know, you know, any more specifically how those would be delineated in the Hebrew language. But yeah, it's kind of a, this is the expectation. You either follow all of them. If you don't follow all of them, then you don't measure up. And Paul would almost echo that sentiment when he would say, look, in Galatians, he would say, look, if you're going to make the law code your standard for salvation, then you better follow all of it. If you're going law instead of grace. And so that's kind of, you know, Paul's own sentiment there. Yeah. Spirit of the law versus the letter of the law. Yeah. Yeah. It's a fair question. Yeah. I don't know if y'all heard him. He asked about, you know, where the delineation of the spirit of the law versus letter of the law comes from. And I don't know that it's a biblical idea. I think that may be more of a later study of legalism idea, but I'm not sure. Does anybody know anything more about that? I do think it's a fair question, because in much of Christian history, we want to get into the letter of the law and follow it literally, but then we come into challenges where we deal with, and we're going to see this in the matter on anger. So is ever feeling anger sin and outlawed by Jesus in this context? That would be the legal letter of what is said. And then we look at our own life experience and common sense and say, wait a minute, is that even possible? Is that even possible? So, yeah. They are. The law is a crushing weight if you let it be. And I think that, you know, as part of this study, we don't look at Paul and Paul's distinguishing between the law and the gospels. But he would say, you know, he would use language like the law was your babysitter. You know, the law was never designed to be your entryway into heaven. It was designed to educate you, to teach you. And, you know, again, in Galatians saying, if you're gonna ask them to do this, then they have to do all of it. If you're going to trust the law, you have to follow all of it. I think there's a difference there in how the Jewish rabbis of Jesus' day were treating the law, as opposed to what Jesus is talking about here when he says, I've come to fulfill the Torah. I think what Jesus really means is I've come to fulfill all of the things that God revealed about himself and how his people are supposed to live, how his people are supposed to emulate his character. And that's dabbling back over into spirit of the law kind of sentiment, I think.
Romans 8:2 in the NIV says, because through Christ Jesus, the law of spirit who gives life sets you free from the law of sin and death.
Okay. Did y'all catch that? Romans 8:2, the law of the Spirit who gives life will set you free from the law of sin, which brings death, or the law of sin and death. Yep.
But I tell
you,
Yeah.
So that's where we're going, yeah, and that's where this is kind of setting the stage for us, is to enter into that conversation. And And so that is the question. When Jesus would say, I mean, let's look at a case in point, verse 21. You've heard it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, which is one of the Ten Commandments, not just a random law. He says, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, raka, or sometimes translated as fool, it's an insult or an expletive in Aramaic. Anyone who says that to his brother is answerable to the Sanhedrin, but anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. So let's go back to our nuances of fulfillment. What is Jesus doing here? Is he adding on? Is he revealing the spirit of the law, the perfected spirit of it? Is he boiling down to just love your brother? Is he, what is he doing? Is he revealing a better way? Is he revealing what the eschatological kingdom of God is going to be like? What's he doing here? You've heard it said this, but I tell you this. It was a hand. Larry, was that you? Yeah.
Before anything else. If you go forward and do the acts, you don't be false.
Yeah.
Thought about it, and then after you thought about it, put it down because you said, no, that's wrong. Then you thought it through, and you decided, no, that's not wrong.
Yeah. So let's look at these other passages I've given you for context. Ephesians 4:26, you'll recognize these, most of you. Paul writes, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. Do not give the devil a foothold. So Paul acknowledges that anger is a precarious place into which you can move into sin, but he stops short of saying that anger itself is sin. He says, in your anger, take care. This is what you were saying, Larry. Take care not to do something violent or foolish. Right. I'm going to look at these other Pauline texts since I'm here. Colossians 3:8. Paul says, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these. And the first one he lists is anger, rage, malice, slander, filthy language, etc. But he says you must rid yourself of these things, rid yourself of anger. Galatians 3:1.
Hmm?
Oh, we're going there. We're going there. Paul in Galatians 3 says, you foolish Galatians. Paul calls the Galatians fools. What do we make of that in light of Jesus' sentiment that if you call your brother fool, you'll be in danger of the fires of hell? You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Before your very eyes, Christ was portrayed as crucified. And then in the Gospels, a couple of texts in Mark chapter 1, verse 41, and this is a textual variant. It may not show up in the NIV. Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I'm willing, he said, be clean. There are some of the earliest texts of this passage that don't say filled with compassion, but say filled with anger. That in that context of healing a man with leprosy, Jesus was angry and it prompted him to heal. Chapter 3, verse 5, this is Jesus being chastised about healing on the Sabbath, I believe. And it says, he looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and his hand was completely restored. The Pharisees were challenging Jesus about healing on the Sabbath, and Mark says he looked around at them in anger. And then the passage that that Debs mentioned, Matthew 21, what are we to make of Jesus turning over the tables of the money lenders, money changers in the temple courts? Matthew 21, verse 12 to 17. Jesus entered the temple area, drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer. You're making it a den of robbers. The blind and lame came to him at the temple. He healed them. But when the chief priests and teachers of the law saw the wonderful things he did and the children shouting in the temple area, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were indignant. Do you hear what these children are saying? They asked him, yes, replied Jesus, have you never read from the lips of children you have ordained praise? It doesn't specifically say that Jesus was angry, but we do kind of have a hard time imagining him going through there and very politely and calmly turning the tables over and telling the people to leave. And seems to be a little bit more emotive. And it's been 4 weeks since I lectured in this course last, so apologies if you don't recall. But one of the introductory points I made was that when we interpret the Sermon on the Mount, we really have to use Matthew's entire gospel as a context by which to understand it. And we also need to use the other gospels and Paul. But in many cases, Matthew, when Jesus says, blessed are the meek, if we want to understand what he means by meek, we need to look at Jesus portrayed throughout the gospels. And meek doesn't always mean sitting on your hands and being passive. And this case in Matthew 21 is a good example. If we want to understand fully what Matthew's talking about, the gospel as a whole is its context. So whatever Jesus is talking about here, about anger, being angry with your brother, we have to keep these other passages in mind. You see some history of interpretation. For the most part, early Christian tradition followed this misdirected anger sentiment, or anger acted out inappropriately. That would be their interpretation, that you can have the emotion, but you cannot give inappropriate venting to that emotion. There have been some, particularly in monastic tradition, who have said, you know what, you need to work as a discipline simply to do what Paul said in Colossians 3, to eliminate anger from your life, period. That's a noble goal. Is it a realistic one in the sinful, fallen world? I mean, we can imagine that in heaven, there won't be anger because there won't be reasons to be angry. And so it is a quality of the kingdom of God that anger is absent. But as long as we live in this world, is that a realistic expectation? Yes?
There's a footnote about brother in my Bible. It says some manuscripts say brother without cause. Your anger.
Oh, interesting. Without cause. Okay. There have been other interpreters that have seized on that, and they've said really what he's talking about here, that normally in Matthew and in other New Testament texts, when he uses the word brother, it's talking inclusive language about people within the fellowship of Christ followers. And so it's not talking about being angry with what's going on outside the community of faith, but is with, you know, with yeah. 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 And I think, I mean, I like this sentiment as well. Yeah. Yeah. But even still, we're forced to look at the example of the church in our world today and say, even that's still a pretty high, lofty goal to not be angry even with other Christians. But what we're trying to get to the sense of what Jesus is communicating, whether we think it's attainable or not. Remember, many people want to soften the Sermon on the Mount to the point of making it lose its potency. And then you've had people who want to elevate it to word-for-word legalistic status to the point where you can't even hope to follow it, and you certainly can't hope to live within modern society. That was Tolstoy's dilemma. He decided that I need to live this accordingly, and then all of a sudden, even people in the church, he had no ability to interact with people. So how do we find a balancing act where we're not subverting it, but we're also not creating within Christianity this impossible, unattainable goal? Yeah. Right.
Do we say they're wrong and I'm right, so forth and so on? Or do you realize that there's always going to be nuance?
Yeah.
Things that understand that has no bearing on the truth.
Yeah. I've given you a couple of Old Testament examples here just for consideration, because they do speak to, I mean, if anything that we're trying to do here is trying to eliminate the possible severity of what anger can produce in us, the Old Testament really just, I mean, it lands on this. Proverbs does, Psalms does, Proverbs 14, verse 29, a patient man has great understanding, but a quick-tempered man displays folly. You know, we recognize that. Psalm 4:4, really all of Psalm 4, but to keep us from having to read all of it. It says, in your anger, do not sin when you are on your beds. Search your hearts and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and trust in the Lord. A lot of stuff that I read, let me go back to Matthew. Let me see if this draws your mind. Remember, Matthew's using the Old Testament a lot, and sometimes it's direct quotes, but a lot of times it's allusions. It's not obvious quotes. So when he puts in the word in the mouth of Jesus, he says, anyone angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. You've heard it said, do not murder. Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Does that draw up any images from the Old Testament for you? Who? There's a couple of possibilities. Yeah. Jacob and Esau would be secondary. Primary would be Cain and Abel. Yeah. And so it points. Right. Right. But Cain being the one who murdered his brother. And so we're kind of hearkened back to the first murder, a brother murder, not just a community of faith, but an actual flesh and blood fratricide. Is that the right word? Yeah, that too. What led to Cain killing Abel? Yeah, I mean, it was a handful of things, but it's, yeah, it's rooted in anger. Yeah, rooted in anger, which might have been precluded by jealousy, but ultimately it's him being angry, and angry gives vent to all kinds of actions. Right. And that may be, I mean, there may be pushing a little bit. Matthew doesn't make it any more explicit than that, but let's look at the, you know, Jesus gives a couple of examples. So verse 23, he says, therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. In other words, he puts reconciliation ahead of religious sacrifice. Very anti-Pharisee, I would suspect. They would say, do your church thing first. And Jesus says, no, no. If you realize that you're not in the right place, you go and be reconciled first and then come back. He goes on, settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. Presumes guilt there, that you're guilty enough to be thrown into prison and charged a fine. So if you have done wrong, then settle matters on your own. Don't force somebody else to do that. You'll see on number three, the examples are much easier to interpret. The importance of reconciliation and the consequences of failing to do so. That we really, when we realize we're not right with somebody, that we should take steps towards reconciliation. I put this quote in here. It bleeds onto the next page. I thought that this was Dale Allison, which is one of the books. That's not the book I don't think that's the one we sold in here. He says, so what the Sermon on the Mount here envisages is not isolated individuals seeking to subdue their passions, but disciples going about the often awkward task of trying to right perceived wrongs. Perhaps in this, the sermon is wisely committing us to the mean between repression and expression, between ignoring our anger and venting it. In a sense, what I took this to mean was, he's saying, a lot of times we might read this and think, whenever we are angered by something, whether it's rightly angered or wrongly angered, many cases, I mean, look, this is classic case in point with the political environment around us. People on one platform or the other find themselves angered by something done or something said on the other side. And out of their anger comes wildly inappropriate speech, lashing out, name-calling, violent actions, violent words. And what the examples add to the challenge is not that when you get angry, you need to stuff it down and squelch it and ignore it. Rather, what he's saying is that you should give action, but the action you should give should be in alignment probably with the Beatitudes instead of contra the Beatitudes. Well, you know, there's a right place for people to be angered by injustice in the world. And when you're angered by injustices in the world, does that move you to redemptive action? Or does that move you to throwing a tantrum or throwing a fit? Passion is a good thing. Sometimes anger can move us. Does anger move you to reconciliation, or does it move you to further widen the gap between you and a person with whom you're angry? Yeah. Yeah.
Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still.
Yeah. Tremble with anger, but do not sin. Right. Right. We're gonna wrestle with this same nuance in the next statement that talks about lust and adultery. Because what we're wrestling with here is the balance between emotions, thoughts, and actions. And where do we draw the line between what constitutes temptation and what constitutes sin? Is the emotion of anger qualify as sin? Paul in Ephesians seems to suggest no. The writer of Psalms seems to suggest no. But we do recognize that anger is probably, it's certainly something, you know, wherever murder comes from or any other violent action, it's more often than not rooted in anger. And so if we do not take care to to be responsible and manage our anger, then we allow ourselves to be placed on the road of all manner of things. So, any other thoughts or comments on this? It's still kind of like, for me, it's still trying to, you know, hold wet sand at the beach. You know, you hold some of it and it slips between your fingers and it's not as solid as we want it to be. But we do understand, this is back to spirit of the law kind of stuff. We understand anger and we know what anger acted out violently looks like. But I do think sometimes we want to focus on the extremes. Anger acted out in warfare, murder, fighting, but sometimes we want to rein back in on anger, given any kind of anger given vent in a manner that doesn't characterize God or Jesus, that is not redemptive or reconciling, is a shorter step on the same road. Do we let our anger move us to passionate action of reconciliation, restoration, healing of injustices, or do we allow our anger to cause us to sin? So, there was a hand, somebody.
Sort of a contrite statement of that today. Hate the sin, love the sinner.
Right.
That's very hard to do.
Right. Now, that's true. So. Yeah. That's tough. Yeah.
There's a lot of people you like to rail against.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't want to say bad things. Sometimes I want to freak them out. But
yeah.
You kind of have a feeling that it doesn't matter what you say, you're not going to fix anything.
Right.
What do you do when that kind of happens? Probably shouldn't even be on the computer that way.
Listen, the comment sections on our news feeds and articles, because it's nameless and faceless. People can get on there and say whatever they want. It's totally different than if you and I sat down over coffee and we read the same article and we disagreed and we could actually try to understand one another. You know, why you think the way you do, why I think the way I do. We may not come to terms, but that can be peaceable, it can be understanding, it can be relationship building. There's none of that on the comment sections online. Yeah. Yeah. So, the challenge with the murder and anger one is there have been those who want to push anger to the point that says any anger at all is sin. And our common sense pushes back against that a little bit. That seems to be unrealistic. We don't have that same problem with lust and adultery. We get, I mean, there's kind of the biblical statement or biblical sense on adultery is fairly uniform. Let's read verse 27. You've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. That is another of the Ten Commandments, sort of. Technically, it's don't covet your neighbor's wife, but do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So, how literal and legalistic do we go with this? Is this only for the looking at women? It does not qualify for the looking at men. I don't know if people look at men lustfully, but is this one of those gender-specific? Yeah. All the snide comments fluttering around. The notes on the back. This passage on lust and adultery, it creates difficulties for different reasons. Adultery is universally condemned in Scripture. We can go to the laws, we can go to Paul, we can look throughout the Gospels. But we also have the case of the woman caught in adultery, you know, that the Pharisees bring before Jesus and they want him to have her stoned. And of course, Jesus doesn't. Where are those that have condemned you? Well, it does. But even still, I mean, Jesus doesn't say, he doesn't send them and say, go find the other one and then let's get him. He says, go and sin no more, you know. He doesn't condone it. He doesn't condone it, but he does act mercifully on her behalf. Adultery is universally condemned in Scripture. What this passage does is push the boundary beyond action to intention. That if in your mind you're thinking lustfully or making intents to act such, then that qualifies. It's the same thing as anger, but the lines aren't drawn as clearly really on either of them. Where you draw the line between a thought coming in and your mind dwelling on or planning or intending action and you actually taking action. Are those three different domains? The Bible often says to be tempted is not to sin. Temptation comes. And so, the thought, the intention, the sin, where do we draw those lines? And I don't know that it's, I don't know that we can, that it's really that clear. Some distinguish between the entrance of a thought, the intention to act as it relates to Matthew. At what point is this temptation versus sinful action? And then you read the examples. It says, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. We don't have to work around this on where are the limits for adultery, quite like the way we do. Where are the limits for lust, lustful thinking? Jesus would say lustful thinking is, you know, that's the same thing that unchecked anger is in the previous matter. Is Jesus affirming self-mutilation? Nowhere in Christian practice. I shouldn't say nowhere because there have got to be people somewhere who did. But in large part, no. What he's speaking to is the severity of the issue and to the difficulty, I think, of the item, the matter at hand. He recognizes that keeping your sexuality in check is difficult. It's challenging, but that it has to be taken seriously. So, where this item gets to be a little bit stickier is in the next couple of verses when he further pushes adultery into the domain of divorce. We'll go there unless anybody has any questions or comments on just the verses there, verses 27 to 30. I think they're a little bit easier to interpret and follow, but it does open up a little bit here when we come to the subject of divorce. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think, well, and to prove your point or to argue along with your point, Rusty, when he says, if you call your brother a fool, you're in danger of the fires of hell, and then we have Paul calling the whole Galatian church, you foolish Galatians, clearly I think you have a little bit of hyperbole there as well. But remember, I mean, hyperbole is not caricature. Hyperbole is exaggeration for the point of emphasis. He's trying to emphasize something significant. And so when he says, if you call your brother a dork or you call your kids an idiot or stupid, he's not saying, oh, you're in the danger of the pits of hell. But he is saying that to carelessly name call somebody something really begins to develop in you the habits of, you know, of giving voice to your anger in inappropriate ways that really could lead you into much more dangerous, much more violent, much more angry actions. And so he's not trying to undermine it. We would look at that sometimes and think, ah, ha, ha, you know, I cut off your hand and pluck out your eye. That's, of course, Jesus didn't mean that, ha, ha, ha. Whereas what Jesus doesn't mean literally cut your hand off, but what he's saying is that this matter is significant and you need to take it seriously. You need to treat it with appropriate severity. But yeah, I do think, Rusty, that Jesus clearly knew what hyperbole, he probably didn't call it that, but he understood exaggerating his point in order to emphasize it, and he does that often. Camel the rich man getting into heaven, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. That's another case in point. So maybe he did, huh? I have no idea. But that's, of course, a possibility. It's a weird word. So on divorce, verse 31, it has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. My study Bible quotes back to Moses in Deuteronomy 24. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress. And anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have the same gender specific issues. Are these only applying to men divorcing or women being adulteresses if they remarry? And I don't think that we can universally say that. I think that's culturally, you didn't have women divorcing men very often or ever back in that world. Today, it's kind of, both parties play both roles from time to time. But this matter of divorce, where adultery connects with marriage, Jesus would say here that that is grounds for divorce. He suggests that's the only grounds for divorce. And in much of the history of Christianity, that's kind of been the way divorce has been handled. Here are some other places where Jesus' statements on divorce. Remember, none of these are Jesus quotes necessarily verbatim. They may be. But these are the traditions of followers restating what Jesus taught decades after Jesus had died. And so you get some variety. Paul in 1 Corinthians, and Paul wouldn't have even been around. Paul would have heard this from other apostles. So Paul's getting it secondhand. Paul would have been third-hand information. But 1 Corinthians 7, verse 10 and 11, he says, to the married, I give this command. This is not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, I'm not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who's not a believer, and he goes on. But he specifies there, no remarriage after divorce for the wife. Luke chapter 16. Verse 18. Law and the prophets proclaimed, it's easier for heaven and earth. Verse 18, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery. And the man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Mark chapter 10. Verse 11 and 12. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. If she divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery. In that case, it says tomato, tomato. For what's good for one is good for the other, both husband and wife. And then within Matthew's own gospel, chapter 19, verse 9, he speaks about this again. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. So in Luke and Mark, it doesn't give the qualifier for adultery. Both in Matthew and two different places, it does. So how do we reconcile the language about adultery in the context of marriage, divorce? You see there on number two, many have argued that adultery allows for divorce, and if adultery is present, remarriage is permissible. This is largely the attitude of much of Christian tradition. If adultery is present and the cause for divorce, then remarriage is permissible. Some have argued that divorce is permitted when adultery is present, but no remarriage is allowed. Long before the modern cultural views within Protestantism, the Eastern Orthodox Church would say that we shouldn't take what Jesus is saying here as legislative, that there's a lot of cultural factors at play in the Roman world, and we need to really work within the spirit of the law here and not the letter of the law here. I'm putting my words on what I understand the Eastern Orthodox position to be, but also putting my words on how do we assimilate the way it's practiced today in our context. Divorce, you know, used to kind of be really, really anathema within the Christian church, and you'd have a hard time, you know, you'd have a hard time getting a job as a pastor. You'd have a hard time being permitted to serve as a deacon if you'd been divorced. And in just my lifetime, it's almost become a non-factor in a lot of churches. And it's not that we don't think it's important or don't think it's a big deal. It's just become much more commonplace. And so, how would you summarize the church's stance on divorce today?
How many of you in here have taken a pencil that you didn't want and you've been forgiven? How many of you could maybe have committed adultery, but you can still be forgiven for that just as well as stealing?
Yeah. 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 Yes. I don't know how many of you guys follow modern law in the Middle East. I don't know if this is Middle East or in India, Saudi Arabia, India somewhere. It's been in the news just recently, maybe Saudi Arabia. And husbands could just divorce their wives by fiat. They would just say it three times. Yeah. And then it was done. And it didn't matter what the grounds were. They could just decide, I don't want to be married to you anymore. And
was it Hosea who waited for his wife to come back?
Right. Something that's always been really profound to me, and I do think, and I think that what Jesus, in the same sense of anger, Jesus is getting back to, Moses allowed for divorce. God's intent was Genesis 2, 3, 4. It was one man and one woman. It was Adam and Eve. Moses permitted a lot of things. The Old Testament permitted, you know, polygamy was a cultural phenomenon throughout the Old Testament. Divorces were allowed. But Jesus would say that's not the ideal. It's not God's intent. And so I do think that order and that commitment is a big part of it. Culturally speaking, women were much, much more vulnerable in the biblical world than they are today because of education, because of job opportunities, ability to provide for themselves. In most of these ancient cultures, women had to have a male provider, and it would either be your father or your husband or your son. And if you did not have one of those, then you were as good as homeless in a lot of cases. You didn't have a way. And in parts of the world, it's that way today, right? And so,
people who are native Saudi Arabians are given a stipend from the government. But if you are a woman and you are a widow or divorced or don't have a son or whatever, you don't get
a stipend.
You are begging on the street.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. That, to me, that very much is, that's a cultural window into what life would have been like back then. And so, a lot of these divorce laws, marriage was supposed to be a commitment. It was supposed to be, you know, a covenant that you kept. But part of the divorce laws were there to protect women from simply being abandoned or taken advantage of. That's why so many of the divorce laws speak to men divorcing their wives. The law is not given to women divorcing their husbands because that was almost assumed to not be a cultural issue, whereas today it is. If somebody really wanted to interpret biblical theology on divorce literally, then they would look at that and say men can't divorce their wives, but women can divorce their husbands. It doesn't speak to that, you know, in large part. So, thank you for transitioning for me. It has, and I don't know if you guys followed the saga of Paige Patterson, the late president of Southwestern Seminary. he's simply a visible case in the news, but he's a good example of a lot of people in religious leadership in the Catholic Church and Protestant leadership, Protestant churches that advised women in abusive, dangerous relationships to stay put and not divorce their husbands because abuse wasn't adultery. And they would read this and say, it's not adultery, therefore you need to stay put. And because this has come up, you know, several years later, it cost him his reputation and his position at the seminary. But it does illustrate sometimes the danger of reading these so legalistically that we might check our common sense at the door. And I think there's been some help, you know, with us realizing that divorce, look, we can stand on the Bible. God hates divorce, yes. Is divorce a bad thing? I've never talked to anybody who's been divorced that would disagree with that sentiment, that would say divorce is a horrible thing. We hated it, you know, it was miserable, it's hard, continues to be. But sometimes you're in a scenario where what you're dealing with is not a good option and a bad option. What you're dealing with is divorce, which is a bad option, or staying in a dangerous and abusive environment, which is also a bad option. And in those environments, I think what advice needs to be given is you need to protect yourself and you need to protect your families. Abuse of a spouse, domestic violence, is a breaking of the marriage covenant in the same way that adultery is. It's a breaking of the marriage covenant. And in that context, divorce is not the breaking of the covenant. The abuse is the breaking of the covenant. And I would argue that abuse is grounds for divorce the same way that I would adultery is. Is divorce, and this goes back to, you know, Deb's, your sentiment, that is divorce painful and horrible and God hates it? Yes. Does that push us beyond the boundaries of God's grace and mercy and forgiveness? Clearly and absolutely not. So, case in point. Case in point. Yeah. The consequences were grave. It was hard, but you're right. He does seem to have been forgiven. And so, yeah, G. Well, because there was an expectation that men were responsible for taking care of women. And you don't have 10 wives unless you can take care of and provide for 10 wives. You know, so that's why Solomon, and it really speaks to the fact that, in all honesty, the numbers given to Solomon for his wives and his concubines is probably hyperbole, Rusty. It's probably exaggerations to speak to his wealth, much more so than it is probably literal count. But it does speak to the fact that Solomon could have this many wives because Solomon had this much money. How many cars in your garage? You know, it's we're past our time, and so I don't know that we settle the issue. But I do wrap up on these last couple of points. In many cases, the decision to be made by the Christian can be between two undesirable options. In this instance, we acknowledge that divorce is not God's ideal, but we have freedom to move forward with whichever choice we think is right, and we do so under the umbrella of grace and mercy. And I think that's where we have to understand the gospel of forgiveness and grace and mercy. The clear sense of the passage, however, stands contrary to the common culture where divorce sometimes is done. You know, irreconcilable differences can mean all kinds of things, you know, and divorces can be granted for all kinds of petty reasons, or we just can't get along, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I think there are lots of reasons. Well, I don't want to go too far down that road. What constitutes grounds for divorce within the biblical world, and what does not? And I think what the Bible would say is, what I read it to say is, divorce should always be the last resort when all other options have been exhausted. But I think we all have seen cases where there comes that point at where divorce may indeed be the lesser of two evils. And when it comes to that point, we as a church, I as a pastor, we want to be about helping people pick up where they are and move forward with meaningful relationships in the future. If reconciliation is a possibility, then we would advocate that. It's where the messiness of our lives and our sinful world clash with the ideal of what we expect the kingdom of heaven to be. And we can always aim for the ideal, strive for the ideal, advocate for the ideal, but we don't live there yet. We don't live there yet, and so we still have to be the kingdom. This is where that sentiment of fulfilling is reducing the laws to loving people. And look, somebody can be as legalistic about the Bible as they want. I can't fathom looking at a battered wife and telling her she needs to not divorce her husband. She needs to go back into that relationship. I can't. To me, that does not constitute love for that battered spouse. I say wife. That's an unfair gender assignment too. It could be a husband. A battered spouse in that context. But that's where common sense and love for people kind of takes over for me over what sometimes traditional ways of understanding and interpreting the Bible is. And if we allow for too much of that, then we become the authority instead of God's word. We don't want to go that far. But all the law and prophets, I mean, all the laws are boiled down to this. We love God with all of our hearts, and so we speak and we act with compassion. We love our neighbor as ourself, and we do everything we can to help them. And so I think, you know, it's an art more than a science. Every case has to be handled on its own, case-by-case basis. When churches create systems, that's when people like Dr. Patterson get themselves in trouble. No divorce whatsoever unless it's adultery, very legally defined. And then we get ourselves in trouble by sending poor, abused spouses back into unsafe homes and environments. And that is not God's ideal either. So, anyways, I'd encourage you to read and pray, and we continue to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. And rest on the grace and mercy of God. So, you have also heard it said, dealing with oaths, dealing with retaliation, dealing with love for your enemies. And so we'll cover those categories 4, 5, and 6 next Wednesday, and I'll be with you again for that. So hope you guys have a great week. Love to see you back next week. We dive into a few weeks on prayer Sunday in worship, so hope you're able to make it out for church Sunday morning. Should be good.